Good evening. Tonight, I am pleased to introduce Christian Barter, Bates class of 1990. Born and raised in Maine, Christian took his BA in music composition right here and went on to do an MFA at Vermont College's esteemed writing program. Since then, he has supervised a trail crew in Bar Harbor, doing stonemasonry and tree work and forest fire fighting. His poems have appeared in many magazines, such as the Georgia Review, the American Scholar, the North American Review, and his work has been recognized with fellowships from the Nelson and Espy Foundations. He lives in Southwest Harbor. Many people are accustomed to thinking of music in poetry as a matter of measure, of repetition and occasional departure. But Christian Barter, rightly, I think, understands poetry's music in the context of sentence, as a matter of tone and tempo and turning. He writes effortlessly sinuous long sentences that sing, that speed up and slow down, and turn onto troubling tributary roads where unsuspected discoveries rear up, at once funny and frightening, engaging and sobering, inviting and lonesome. His poems have admirable and promising range. They remember, observe, speculate, and ruminate with equal skill and grace. As a matter of his temperament, I suspect, he also understands that the soul of humor is something generously mordant, that in every chord of laughter there is a melancholy note. He dependably finds that note and all the grateful, wondering, bitter, hilarious others without excessive flourish. In poems that can be both unabashedly personal, one might even say private, and also fearlessly public, that is, at large with the historical and social experience that we bear and think about together and call culture. So listen up. Christian's is one big, capable, valuable, and available talent, and his poems are likewise. Please welcome back Christian Barter.
Such a strange pleasure to have yourself laid bare so articulately. Thanks, Rob. I haven't been here since 91. Driving by, I noticed some new buildings. I see everyone's been busy since I've been gone. Very busy. I'm going to launch into a couple poems, and if anything supremely interesting occurs to me as I go along, I'll be sure to share it with you. Friends, I am sick of the world. Friends, I am sick of the world. Sick of the way it holds its hand out and yanks it back. You will say I am feeling sorry for myself, and I am sick of that. I am sick of every day's demand to be loved, its cute sunrises and moonrises and rains and winds and heartbreakingly quiet snows coming down like the hush of young mothers. You will say I am bitter. I know. You will say I should get a life, and I have tried. Do you think it's for nothing? I spent 6 or 8 years drinking and belting bad songs from bar stools. My level of commitment should not be in question here. If I say the night is as boring as a long flight, it's because I have been up in it for years. You will say I am trying to pick a fight. Oh, friends, nothing could be less true. It isn't you I blame for this catastrophe of day after day after day with the same smirk on its face, always wringing you out of sleep like a telemarketer. Though even my dreams are getting old, the same old lovers traipsing around the same old passages, the same old feeling that something has been irredeemably lost. If there's one thing I'm sick of, it's that. You will say, no doubt, I'm being melodramatic, as though I were the problem. Friends, if it were up to me, there'd be a moratorium on boredom, and dancing wouldn't be so ridiculous, or instruments so hard to play. And if you wanted to feel a certain way, that's how you'd feel. End of story. Marcel. She came to my dorm room and stayed the night with me a couple times. Rare bouts of innocence in those days of always shoving in like a pushy fan trying to get to the stage. And kept her clothes on, sleeping in jeans like we were trapped in an airport or something, snuggling up to me with that nonplussed look of hers and letting me kiss her, I think, for whatever that would have been worth. It was absolutely nothing that brought us together. Perhaps a class, or that she lived three doors down and left her door open while she typed. Her studious, generous face like a lamp left on in some old empty house. Me coasting on marbles home with a cigarette going. Me, who got in the habit of stopping to talk, maybe just because my ears were ringing with the silence of the place. And yet it is her I am thinking of tonight with a tenderness that is almost like sleep. It is so natural and so safe from the sweaty effort of another day walking in my heavy armor. It's a nation-founding myth that years bring wisdom. I still have no idea why she slid into bed beside me those two nights, weeks apart, saying nothing, perhaps, as would have been her way at such a time, clasping me in her sweatered arms as though sex were a thing of the past, and new snow building up fast on the runway. Things I've forgotten. All my best first lines, for instance. They come to me while I'm driving so fast, myself lags behind, or when I'm riding the elevator up into sleep and the unseen streets are dropping away below me. How exactly Socrates proved all knowledge is remembered. The names of some of the women I've slept with, who assassinated whom, the books I read last year, the faces of some, how it felt to be 18, 19, 27, or yesterday morning with Sonny Rollins, blowing the doors from some passageway reeking of 1965 and a thirst I was born with, how to get anywhere I've only been once, and some places I've been going all my life, blowing like hope and death had woken up in the same bed and were trying to disentangle themselves. It had something to do with a boy and the spaces inside of squares. What happened between the fall of Rome and the Battle of Hastings? When exactly Christianity gave up on poverty? When Mesopotamia fell? When Crete? When Greece? When Rome? When Byzantium with its gold mosaics? The Saxons, the Mayans, the Franks, the Visigoths, the eunuchs, the mammoths, the dodo birds, at least one of them was the idiot, where salvation is no better than a seizure, or is that what he meant? Who said, we have seen the enemy? What it was I thought I needed to say with sleep pulling up on my shores like stout Cortez, who Proserpine was, what Sisyphus did, when it was I last knew, and the time before that, what was said between so many of us before the long stutters of our fuckings and sleep taking over like a stunned vice president. To the unborn. We have smoked all the cigarettes and sold the last pack years ago, but I think you'll thank us once you read the research. That much we took upon ourselves. So, remember, smoking kills. Beware of radiation, mercury, and ground-level ozone, and for God's sakes, wear your seatbelts in whatever kind of wacky cars you make. We've left some ideas for those, by the way. What else? Enjoy the place. We wish it could have been better, but we had long retirements, most of us, and you know how expensive that can be. How time flies. I must admit, we were caught off guard by some things. We hope you get along, but if you don't, there are plenty of nuclear weapons for you to use. Just keep in mind, they really should be launched by democratic nations, otherwise all hell could break loose. Sorry about the farmland, but at least there's a copy of the latest food pyramid lying around somewhere. So eat healthy, and remember to take life one day at a time. Lord knows it gets by quickly. The secret of our happiness, I'd say, was in accepting what we could not change. As Rob mentioned, I live up in Bar Harbor, Southwest Harbor, on Mount Desert Island. I work out in the woods, and up until recently, found myself in local bars a fair amount, and not so good for some things, but pretty good for creating poems now again. And if you just sort of can listen into what's going on. And this is one of those. It's called The Opponent. Right off the bean, a guy named Whitey drags my friend into a conversation about how the road salt hurts his Harley, or whatever that shit is they're using now. And the game is on, but there's no sound because this place is more of a restaurant. So I watch the silent attacks, each team driving the other one back down the court, then throwing the ball around like it was just a game after all. And I watch the earnest faces of the commentators for which the outcome could not be more important, where this God with all his archangels runs smack into the Antichrist and found him a mean ball handler. Until Whitey gets going about burning brush with great fervor. And by then, Illinois is slaughtering Louisville. So I listen too as he explains how you need to put old tires under the pile before you make it, because once those things get going, there's no stopping. You could go through a pile 10 feet high and wetter than fucking hell once they get going. And he is smiling the smile of a man who has conquered many brush piles in this manner. And now the couple at the other end of the bar is laughing, and the woman says, "You are such men talking about burning brush piles." And Whitey flares up a bit and says, "You think I'm joking, but it's true about them fucking tires." And the bartender doesn't tell him to quiet down because she's his girlfriend. She just looks up from washing a glass and smiles at the couple on his behalf, the smile of someone used to picking up the shards. But it's okay anyhow, because the woman at the bar doesn't give a shit, and then neither does Whitey. And by now, Illinois is definitely trouncing Louisville. And there's a close-up of one of their cheerleaders, whom I try like hell not to be driven mad by. Just yesterday, plucked off the vine and stuffed in this tiny uniform, who is bouncing with ecstasy that the Fighting Illini, named for some of the biggest losers in history, are making history on the court today, as the silent announcers are probably trying to tell us. But Whitey is telling a story now about a guy he lives next to up in Harrington who is so damn stupid he built his pig barn on posts that weren't even dug in the ground. And you know what pigs do? That's right, they burrow. And now all of us are laughing in anticipation as Whitey says victoriously, "That morning when I drove by, the barn was standing." I don't know if this is a nod to being back at my old school, but I'm going to read a few poems that are about books, inspired by books. This one's called Dostoevsky's People. Easily offended, usually wrong, self-flagellatory but laughing it off 1 minute later, irritable, faithless, aware always of their own inadequacies but unable to correct them, rhetorically gifted but completely closed-minded, vengeful, impassioned, often drunk, rarely holding down a job, they are completely unsure of why they are there. Well, they take stabs at it, of course. Sometimes so convincingly you begin to feel your own feeder roots basking in rich soil, but always hurl themselves back as from a stranger lurking behind a door. Their best words are rescinded with the most zeal. They are murderers one moment, saviors of mankind the next, and can't seem to decide which, if either, is their real self. Still wedded, most of them, to the idea that such a thing exists, and some of them even to right and wrong, preconceptions which make their actions ridiculous as they grub for money or toss it literally into the fire, express the deepest love, knelt down in the executioner's dirt, or laugh in the face of the same man as they hop into a carriage of the lowliest sort they can find, never a shortage, simply to cause agony. The dying feel the most alive. The impotent love the most fiercely, and dignity is a show dog they lash in public, especially if it ribbons. One wants to almost renounce his humanhood in the company of such people, faced with the choice of murderer, sycophant, or ridiculous saint who is helpless to change the others, and even seems to assist them in realizing their worst tendencies. One begins to link his own noblest actions with the most despicable results. Well, Dostoevsky, you have riddled me to exhaustion. I leap at the chance to close this notebook on these foolish observations I have made with such self-deceitful pride. I who have been tormented and laughed at in the face, and leave for another day of breaking stones. The sun also rises. 1. Hemingway, your story moves by virtue of its vacuum in the middle. Your people desire nothing, but more importantly, nothing desires them. And as your stories desire only to become stories, your people desire only to become people. Substance is reserved for sport, bullfights, big game hunting, insults, wars. 2. Oh, darling, I've been so miserable, Brett says. But it's only hysterics, and the stoicism of Jake is merely the absence of hysterics. It's by removing everything we know of life that Hemingway shows us life. Here, he says, is a thing that isn't life. From this, you can figure out what is. 3. Honestly, do we give a shit about Lady Ashley? But that's not how he works, making us cheap friends. Not with people, not with staying drunk for 7 days in Pamplona watching bullfights, and certainly not with knocking down 3 men because they refuse to indulge your fantasy, which is to say, for not loving you. Go make your own friends, Hemingway says. Get one of them to wreck your face. 1 more book poem. A Room with a View. How fortunate that last meeting with Mr. Emerson in the church. How much like an intervention of God or the writer. And that Lucy would see his meaning and understand at last that she loved George, and that George would not have offed himself or left the country or put himself in a death-like trance, calling forth the need for unreliable messengers. This is all very fortunate. Not to mention being born with money and good looks and not, in that day and age, having died or been disfigured by one or another then horrifying disease. I see once again that love is for the very lucky, or else there is some will that will not, generally speaking, be frustrated by details. Will you, M, now insurmountable in your other life, wander someday into my church, confused, and be turned toward the life I have long imagined? This book made it seem as though you would, and for that, I threw it at the wall. It's somewhere out of sight in another room. This is what's commonly referred to as a list poem, which for any of you out there who are beginning to write poems, as I was when I was here, it's a pretty easy way to write a poem. You just kind of start with a concept and start listing things, and sometimes they begin to hang together in a way that works out all right. This is called The Phoenix. Being ash, being dust, being what's left on the plate, being the bungalow with a moss-eaten roof, a stone's throw off from the new glass house, being bone and gristle, being biomass, being something stuck to the fridge floor, whiffing of a long-turned tide. Being shredded, unsought secrets. Being car exhaust. Being half-buried, rusted-out bed springs, sleeping it off in the woods. Being what was washed from the photo by the years. Being what will never wash. Being what's in the storm drain, hurrying off. The dust flaring up in the comet's tail, the toenail clippings feeling around under the rug, the sticks laid out on the highway after a storm, the pennies on the dashboard short of a dollar, the hollow core of an old swamp cedar, the crumpled butt of the sweetest cigarette you ever had. I am everywhere, and I demand my wings. Let's see how that works. Just kind of stack things up, and then by the end of all that stacking, something occurs to you to wrap it all up. This is on the other end of the spectrum. This is a sonnet, which unfortunately I have to memorize about 1,000 of them before I can write one myself by the time the rhythm gets into you. And then I sit down and choose to write something about the Bee Gees. I don't know why. This is called Oh Lord, I Sit in My Own Ear Humming, one of those addresses to God. O Lord, I sit in my own ear humming tonight, only an old Bee Gees song vivid in this unopenable box we call the mind, to sing me back to 1979, that familiar smelling, comfortably lived in time before boners and shame and the deep rite of coming. Lord God above, are you sincere? Ridiculous falsetto. Ridiculous memory like a disc. Ridiculous sonnets from the seeds you shot in here. You've wasted so much on this atheist. Yet this is how you made me, Lord, as sure as this music from nothing. So foolish and so pure. I'm almost proud of what I am, unblessed. Those were almost all sort of newish poems. So now that I've got that part over with, it's always sort of frightening to stand up in front of people and read stuff that you just ripped off. But I'm gonna read a few from the book, which has been kicking around long enough that, you know, I feel better about it, I guess. Back in my day, when I was here at Bates, I lived. I don't know what it's like now. I hear from Sam that things are a little bit different, but I lived in the Bill. At the time, you know, that was it was just, you know, you could get a contact high walking anywhere nearby the building. God, it was crazy. Okay, I could go on and on about that. So that's mentioned in this poem, and which has a sort of strange bent, but the Bill's in here. And this is one of many poems I've written about being back here, and which even though I haven't been back here since 91, I very often find myself back here in dreams and memories. And okay, I guess I'll read the poem. It's called The Bridge. At 16, I was killed in a car wreck, crossing the bridge from Sullivan, where I grew up mostly, to Hancock, which is on the way to Ellsworth, where I gotten a job flipping burgers and putting down fries. I would have been a senior that year, developed a drinking problem, lost my virginity in a prefab basement to a girl I didn't know, would never know, gone on to an elite college and studied the works of Hegel and Schopenhauer and Beethoven, learned that they were German romantics and not much more, due to my drinking problem, which by now would have turned into habitual marijuana smoking and sleeping around. I guess it would have been fun for a while, living like that. I think I would have chosen Kim to fall in love with, have kissed her right there in Roger Williams Hall at a keg party, have helped her with her garnet coat and walked her home nights after starchy dinners, fingers cinching with fingers in the itchy wool pocket, then drunk myself away from her for 3 straight months until I came home to a short note. I digress. It's easy to get carried away with things that never happened, to get saddened by some life that might have been, though, had I lived, I probably would have read Nietzsche, too, who said, "What does it matter that you are failures? How much is still possible?" The accident was due to driver inexperience, excessive speed. He must have been in a terrible hurry to get somewhere. Sometimes when I can't think of something to call a poem, I just call it poem. This is such the case. Poem. With the hope yet of writing a poem this morning, I am sitting in the middle of the kitchen where I can see from the window above the sink the early winter light bringing the old oak to magnificent relief, and can hear the radio's classical guitar asserting itself and struggling to reach doubt. And I am reading from the book of Job, "Is there not an appointed time to man upon earth?" And watching a spider descend by virtue of his own guts across that oak shining as from another earth and touch down on the sink divider and make for some attractive crevice, just being here. There is no such thing, I think, as I hear now Bernstein's drifting violin above some kind of ground that keeps giving way, a piece inspired by Plato's Agathon. Beauty is a call to labor. With the hope yet of writing a poem, smoothing like a coin-rubbed faceless, I watch a single crow pumping the blue he is the absence of, working it hard until the black of the last trees takes him. Oh, what the hell? I'm going to read one more poem about being here at Bates. And then a couple more about other things, which it took me a little while after leaving here to figure out actually existed. This is called The Short Happy Life, and by the end of this poem you'll gather that I'm a pretty serious Hemingway fan. This is about his poem called The Short Happy Life of Francis Macomber. It was the short happy life of Francis Macomber that finally got my attention. Reading Hemingway the night before the exam, trying to scan, pick up plots and names, and thus slide through the way I'd slid through everything, the way I'd keep on sliding years past that through shit jobs, girlfriends, windowless rooms and bars. It simply hit me what Hemingway was talking about. There's a man on safari in Africa or someplace who suddenly finds his courage when he's confronted by a charging water buffalo at 40 or something. And I felt that I would someday find my courage, too, drinking a six-pack to calm those finals jitters. I had been the kid the tough kids jeered and stole his hat and called a fag and beat up now and again, though the beatings were never that bad. The beatings are never that bad, and they come anyway, which is what this guy of Hemingway's realized after he had cowered in the face of some other animal and his wife snuck back to the tent from fucking the guide. The beatings are going to happen. I failed the class and hid behind the library smoking cigarettes while my classmates marched. Macomber's wife blew his head off, seeing that he'd leave her, and Hemingway blew his own head off. I don't know what he saw coming, if he was scared or just bored, but that night my finals meant nothing. I was living my own short, happy life. This is a meditation on Bach's Unaccompanied Cello Suite called Bach's Unaccompanied. 1. Why would we need to march on Dante into the Viennese period and pillage its symphonies, let alone into the year 2000? Where each of a million doorways blasts its own overwrought mix, and everyone is talking. A few who can't seem to talk enough are speaking out of boxes on the walls. Do we need all those voices? Do we need even a piano's commentary? For I have noticed that many voices heard together become a single voice, and that even silence, after a while, will begin to squeak in its chair, to cough. 2. Is it thought or form only? Exquisite form, the thoughts being mine, the way I think of cliff formations, the perfect curve of the horizon, suspended sunset colors. Form only, then, this letter, word, line, the thought as dead as Bach, every bit as dead as the sky, the cliff, the ocean, bulging toward a faint moon. 3. Bach knew what the others guessed. Accompaniment is a ruse, and anyway, unnecessary. Left alone, passages begin to speak to each other. It might be wrong to call it lovingly, but loving is a ruse, and anyway, unnecessary. Take everything away, and the nothingness, I assure you, yes, it is you to whom I speak. The nothingness will sing to itself. Just a couple more. Thanks for having me, Rob. This is surreal and wonderful being up here on the other side of the podium with something to share other than a bag of weed. This is the title poem from my book, The Singers I Prefer. The singers I prefer are the ones who have to struggle. Famously, there is Bob Dylan. and Robert Plant, who might have sung lower but didn't. And now there is this Beth Orton, who seems to be singing through a wall. Through a wall? I would really like to get this right. Granted, the perfect voices on the radio today singing the Ode to Joy made me cry, but I was thinking, in between the floating, the deep hunger of dream memories, of deaf Beethoven locked in his smelly room, Beethoven, who probably never had a woman groan his name in the clutch, scribbling each note at an audience of clefts and inkwells. It was after her face had been scarred in the accident, when her mouth would only open on one side, when it tasted of acrid medicines and something death-like, that I saw for the first time how beautiful M was, how damn funny, if not through a wall, then through some almost crippling pain, the kind that threatens to blot out all the sweetness, even the bursting through of 100 ecstatic voices in a pickup truck in Bangor, Maine, in a snowstorm after a long sadness. This is a poem I wrote some years ago. As you'll see, there's a reference to 1999. I don't know, I felt old then, but now I feel older, so that's a while back. And this is the last one, and thanks for coming out. It's good to see people show up for a poetry reading, even if it's mine. And I guess afterwards I'm going to answer questions if anybody has any, because I'd really be happy to chat about poetry a little bit afterwards. This life is a good life, a lucky life in a Bar Harbor spring, in 1999, where the sun backs in the sliding glass doors and three birds practice their solos for the next millennium. I'm not living in it, but this life is good. A hand-thrown mug of coffee tasting as thick as the ashes of Troy. The faces of women I've loved coming back to this life. This good, good life that lives in May with birds, with a plump gray cat sprawled in a sun patch like the emperor of spring. My God, but it would be a decent life to live the life I live. I yearn for it sometimes, in dreams, when I am far off riding the shrunken boards of a ship, thirsting for that one green spot of the land that will be my home. Thank you. You guys want to know more about the bill back in the 80s? Yeah. Oh man, yeah, good question. Differently now than I used to. As I get older, I find that I revise more. And I'm not sure if I'm, you know, losing it a little and getting it right less often the first time, or whether I'm becoming more picky. But revision is a tough thing. I think sometimes there's this attitude, especially if you've been to a lot of workshops, and you know, there's this idea that you just put enough time in, you can fix it. You know, you just got to put the effort in. You get enough comments pulled together, and you sift through them. You pick the right ones, and you go back with your wrench and hammer, and you take out what's bad. You put in what's good, and I don't find, for me, it doesn't work that way. I have a lot of poems I throw away. I'll say two things. The first one is, I think that even revising a poem that never becomes a decent poem is totally worthwhile, because a lot of times the maneuvers that you learn to do in navigating your way through that one poem, even though it doesn't turn out to be something that you're proud of, you learn those moves, and the next time you sit down to write a poem, maybe they come out the first time around or earlier in the process or in some way that's better. And also I would say that I think we need to be, as writers, careful of revision, because it can also be destructive. And I apologize to, you know, leaders of workshops in here, because it really takes a long time. Revision is definitely a more mature part of the process than just blowing everything out. But I think also a lot of times we ruin poems in revision. They become tight. That we aim for perfection, and there's no such thing. And it's a ridiculous concept, especially in terms of art. What matters is life and energy and power and truth. And those things tend to come straight from the heart, and they may not come out the first time, but I think the revision process, when it's working, is a matter of bringing them out the second time, of the poem being inspiration for the next poem, which uses a lot of the same words, but it's really the next poem, rather than something that's been taken apart and put back together and fixed. Yeah. Good question. Well, I'll say, like, for instance, just for me, it was about 10 years of poems that went into my book. In that process, you know, I probably winnowed down about 1,000 poems to get like 45 for one thing, the poems that I just can't look at without being embarrassed of, those have to go right off the bat. And that's most of the ones, you know, that there's a guttural reaction to a lot of the stuff, I think, when you really look at it and you give it a little bit of time, like 6 months or so, and you come back to it. And there are those poems, you can't face them, you know. They're like, you know, ugh. I really wish I hadn't done that night, you know, and those have to go. And then there are a bunch of other ones that seem promising, but they're fooling you. And, you know, so time is one thing. You kind of figure out where they're fooling you. And then how do you decide what's good? I mean, getting other people's opinions, that's good, especially early in the process. But man, I don't know if I have an easy answer for this. You sit with them, I guess, and you give them time. And Rob, you got any more wisdom on this one?
Time.
Yeah, time is.
Last, then they probably meant to last.
Yeah. Yeah, and in some ways, I always hesitate to give the time answer. You know, it's an easy one for everything, but we're mortal, right? You know, so you can't give everything like forever. Like, well, I don't know yet, so I'll wait another 2. At some point, you gotta come down and make a decision. Okay, you know, this is okay or it isn't. Especially, and I find that in a lot of ways, deadlines help. And I had a great music professor when I was here, and I guess he can't be here tonight. I had Bill Matthews as a music professor when I was here, and one thing he said is, I hardly ever write anything worthwhile without a deadline, because that frames the process a little bit. And I think that you can have a deadline and, you know, submit a poem for it, whether it be a workshop or publication or a book or something like that. And then you can always change your mind. I mean, that's a good thing about poems, is they're there whether you want them to be or not. I mean, provided you don't just burn them up and then fry your brain, you know, they're around, and you can always put them in a folder. And for me, I guess I keep in front of me what's most alive at the moment. And in some ways, it's just the luck of, okay, it's time to finish this manuscript or to submit something to this magazine, and this is what I feel is alive right now. And sometimes I regret it, and sometimes I don't. Yeah.
As a writer, do you journal? I mean, do you write things down that might be inspiring at the moment, but don't have a poem lying within them, or
I don't.
Fighting fires, or
no, I don't. My way into poems is through the language rather than through the thought. Poems. God, I wish I could remember exactly who said it. He was speaking to Mallarmé, and who was writing some poems. And what was it, Mallarmé speaking to someone else? Anyway, these two great intellectuals. One was a painter and one was a poet. And the painter said to the poet, I been wanting to write these poems, and I have all these great ideas, and I sit down and my poems just speak. Do you know this story, Rob? These poems, who do you know who's speaking
it's
to
Mallarmé,
who? It was Mallarmé. Who was writing the poems, right? Who was speaking to the painter? Yeah. And the painter said, you know, I have all these poems, these ideas, and I don't know why. I don't know why my poems just aren't working out. And the poet, whoever it was, said to him, oh, Mallarmé, you have a fundamental misunderstanding here. Poems are not made of ideas. Poems are made of words. And I firmly believe that. And I, for myself, journaling and that kind of thing, I actually find it to be destructive. Now, everybody works in their own way, and certainly Wordsworth, you know. Well, Dorothy, I guess, had the great journals, but he turned, you know, he made the preludes out of his journals. And there have been great journaling poets. But for me, Frost... Frost said about the process of poetry, it's like an ice cube melting down on a hot stove that moves by virtue of its own melting, which implies that by the time it's done, there's no ice cube left. And it's the actual process of writing the poem that creates the poem. So I don't find that I can think of what a poem is and kind of know how it's going to work and then just sit down and write it as a poem later. If it doesn't happen while I'm at the page, if the poem doesn't take place, then for me it's not going to, because what ends up as a poem is actually sort of the skeleton of the beast that lived with me for that time when I was at the page. No questions about the bill. Okay. Anybody? Yeah. At times an unhealthy one. You know, I think both lives feel like something's being stolen away from the other when I'm working on one or the other. And I don't know if it's unfortunate, but that's the reality of the lifestyle of the artist in America, is that, you know, we do other things. And I happen to love my other work. Which is doing trail work, and it's physical work, and it's also creative, which is making these paths that people can walk on and get to the beauty. So I love it, but I'm often cursing it when I'm really wanting to work on a poem, and instead I'm trudging off to work. As far as the beauty of where I live, yeah, I think that's important. I think for me it's very important to live in a life and in a place that's beautiful, that has one way of saying it would be is to be as free of distractions as I can be. I mean, I think distractions are I think probably all of us, myself included, are just naturally creative beings. And, you know, one way we're all sort of these beautiful creative beings that keep running into walls, and they're everywhere. And I find for me there are many fewer walls living in a place of natural beauty that's not noisy and crowded and all those other things. So for me, it's kind of as Paul Simon said, it's just a question of eliminating obstacles, and for me that's the most obstacle-free place that I've found is where I live. But I also want to say about doing the work, I think there are a lot of parallels there, and I think any work that you put yourself into and you really try to figure out its problems can become a metaphor for any other work that you put yourself into and try to figure out its problems, and that the anything that you really truly put yourself into as a full human being with the best intent is gonna, and I don't mean to imply that I do this all the time, but when I've been able to achieve that state of mind, I've found that if I can do that with my trail work, it translates often into my poetry. I find that I've maybe learned something internally from figuring out something with my other work that pays off in a poem. So, Anybody? Anything else?
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you guys. That's great.